We take you now to Las Vegas, where the roulette wheel is about to start spinning on one of the biggest bets in the city's history. The MGM Mirage City Center opens today. It's billed as a city within a city that cost a staggering $8.5 billion to build. The idea is to bring serious contemporary architecture to a city known for kitsch. NPR's Ted Robbins paid a visit.
Even by the immodest standards of the Las Vegas Strip, City Center is huge, 19 million square feet. That's three times the size of the Pentagon. I'm outside in the middle of it, surrounded by glass and steel towers, some curving in graceful arcs, others jutting at hard angles. And above me, a tram, a monorail, linking together City Center and its two neighboring resorts.
Welcome to Crystals. Stand clear of the doors.
Crystals is City Center's high-end mall, designed by Daniel Libeskind. The other City Center buildings, the Mandarin Oriental, Vidara, Veer Towers, the Harmon, are hotels and condominiums. The Aria is City Center's centerpiece, its casino resort. It's where I met the man who guided the project, MGM Mirage CEO Jim Murren. We sat down on contemporary earth-toned furniture in one of its eight lounges, and Murren told me his dream was to build, essentially, a chunk of midtown Manhattan in the desert.
I feel very strongly that just building another casino hotel was not ambitious enough, meaningful enough, or will help move Las Vegas to another level.
Problem is, Las Vegas is having trouble at its present level. The town's been hit hard by the recession. Its unemployment and foreclosure rates are among the highest in the nation. City Center has given 12,000 people jobs, a big boost. But the real estate collapse has hit it like every place else. Condo prices have been slashed by 30%, and Murren says sales have not met expectations.
Had to do it over again, we would have built fewer. We're not going to make the return on it. It's a challenging element of this project.
City Center is highly leveraged. Half the money came from financially troubled Dubai World, though analysts say those troubles won't affect this project. Architecturally, LA Times critic Christopher Hawthorne says City Center is more tasteful than any other place in Vegas. But because MGM chose well-known but mainstream architects, it's not groundbreaking enough to be a world-class architectural destination.
You know, if they were going to spend $8.5 billion, which is what they spent, what if they had hired a really amazingly innovative group of architects who really could have turned this into a spectacular kind of collection of buildings?
One major aspect of the project is innovative. City Center is the world's largest project built to LEED green building standards. From facades made of local Nevada stone to wood from managed forests, the emphasis is on sustainability. For instance, project manager Katerina Tesarova points out the terrazzo floors in Crystals are designed to cool from below.
We conserve energy because we are not cooling all these spaces up there below the ceiling.
Christopher Hawthorne gives MGM Mirage credit for its efforts, but he says there's a basic contradiction between sustainability and a project so much more massive than anything else around it.
One of the most basic rules of sustainability is that you build only as much as you need and you don't waste steel and other materials to build things that either the market or the city or the culture, for that matter, can't bear.
That's more than academic to moguls like Phil Ruffin. Ruffin owns a number of resorts in Las Vegas, including Treasure Island, which he bought from MGM Mirage when it needed cash to finish City Center. He is not thrilled with having 6,000 new hotel rooms on the market.
I open up this many rooms right now. Vegas sure doesn't need the additional rooms, I can tell you that.
Ruffin is worried City Center will drive down prices for everyone, though historically new attractions bring new visitors to Vegas. More a remnant of the boom years than a reflection of the current economy, City Center is likely to be the last big project built here for the next 5, maybe even 10 years. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Las Vegas.
And you can get a look at the sleek high-rises and a couple of leaning towers of Las Vegas at our website, npr.org.
Our small business series continues today from Cucina's Deli in Salt Lake City. The restaurant's sales are down, but profits are up. The owner came up with a creative marketing promotion, or rather a stock market promotion. From member station KUER, Jenny Brundine has the story.
Dean, where do you want these?
It's 9:30 in the morning, but the pace is already starting to pick up behind the counter at Cucina's Deli. Servers deftly prepare curry chicken salads and red-peppered spicy ham sandwiches. The catering orders are starting to pile up.
I took out the first one at 6:45 this morning and hadn't stopped.
Owner Dean Perot says a year ago, it was a different story. November, then December, then January, sales plunged 35%.
That had the hell scared out of me.
Perot's brainstormed. He never liked gimmicks or promotions. But by spring, the recession was getting people down. What about free coffee on Mondays? He had to tie it to something, though. The Dow. All would be right, when the Dow hit 10,000. How about free coffee and lattes on Mondays until that harbinger of good fortune arrived?
It's all free, and I just wanted to do a promotion that was so good it made people suspicious.
Perot's estimates they served 22,000 cups of free coffee. He and his chef Penny Murphy added a green theme. You had to bring your own cup.
And that actually became fairly comical as people bringing in beer steins and people bringing in camelbacks. But Mondays was a circus. It was really funny, and it was really successful. And
we saw people that we'd never, ever seen their faces before.
Most people always bought something to eat as well. Perot's tracked the Dow on a big graph painted on the wall, a thick red line designating the 10,000 mark. The promotion worked, with new faces becoming regulars and boosting sales. Still, that wasn't enough, and manager Shelley Walquist had to cut employee hours.
Everyone had a hard time at first, but we tried to do it in an even way, and you know, maybe everyone took back about 5 hours a person, and slowly we've gained that back, and we've been doing a little bit better.
The 30 part-time employees are busier, and there's been no turnover for an entire year. That's unheard of in restaurants.
Takes caramelized walnuts and blue cheese.
Jeff Murphy also scrutinized food purchases. No more lemons would go bad. She watched more carefully.
I order usually 60 pounds of salmon. I can see that the salmon isn't turning over. So you order, you go back to like 30 pounds. Just you know, keeping an eye on what's selling, what's not selling.
Some customers weren't touching the piece of bread on the side of their plate. Now servers ask if the customer wants it.
Hibachi roll, 17 cents. It adds up.
Sales are still slightly down at Cucina's, 8%, but profits are up. Perot says the recession made him more efficient. He recalls a conversation with a client, also a small businessman.
I said, up until a year ago, there's a lot of things that you had never even crossed your mind. But in essence, I bet that your sales are down. He said, yep. I said, I bet your profitability is probably up a little bit because you've had to make drastic cuts with regards to, you know, your product and your people.
Cucina's is a second home to Robert Brusser, who enjoys a cup of coffee while reading his beloved Scientific American. He keeps an eye on the Dow and has an idea for Perot's.
Well, I think that every time it goes back below 10,000, you ought to bring back the free coffee.
But since the Dow hit 10,000 in October, customers just might be able to afford their own coffee. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine in Salt Lake City.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro, sitting in for Steve Inskeep. The last year has been terrible for many American companies, but it turns out a growing body of research suggests that some companies do quite well in recessions. The winners take advantage of opportunities that just don't exist when the economy is humming along. Kurt Nickisch reports from member station WBUR in Boston.
Daryl Rigby has a really hard job. He advises CEOs on what to do during a downturn as part of his work at the Boston consulting firm Bain & Company. He tells them to think of their companies as race cars careening around a track where recessions are the curves. Rigby says it's hard for companies to pass each other during good times on the straightaway. The big companies stay in front on power alone.
But on a curve, curves are driven by strategic finesse. And so even a company that has less power, if it is skillfully maneuvered in curves, can pass much larger, much stronger competitors.
Rigby has research that backs that up. It shows that market share changes more during a downturn than at any other time. Other research finds that a third of industry leaders come out of a recession as industry laggards, and laggards emerge as leaders. The reason, Rigby says, is that while people and businesses may spend less during recessions, they also spend differently, and that creates opportunities.
It's fascinating that during the last recession, 2001, Apple launched the iPod. You see people like Zipcar rolling out their national strategy.
In that case, people turned to the car sharing company because they wanted to save money by getting rid of a vehicle. Another good example is EMC, a data storage firm outside Boston. Vice President Frank Hauck joined the company back in 1990 when EMC was just a tiny player up against IBM.
I mean, our market share was 0.2% when I started, and I think IBM's share was in the 80s.
But then came a recession. EMC's product offered clients more versatility right when they were looking for alternatives.
Once we saw that we could crack into the biggest accounts on Wall Street, I think that's when people thought anything was possible.
Within a few years, EMC was a major player. Of course, it's easy in hindsight. It's a lot harder when you're in a downturn. Cash is tight. Everyone's panicking. Consultant Daryl Rigby says most companies focus too much on cost cutting and forget to invest in growth.
At a time when others are pulling in their horns and hunkering down, it does leave opportunity because it's just easier pickings. There's not as much competition out there.
Now that this recession is probably over, many companies are waking up to find that their competitors made bold moves during the bad times.
My name is Mike Witinski. I'm the president of Shaw Supermarkets, and we are at the Chestnut Hill store.
Witinski decided to build this new store during the recession.
Close it.
There's a panini station, a pasta bar, and a brick oven pizza service. Witinski says Shaw's is appealing to people who like to eat out but have cut back.
Great restaurant quality food at much lower than restaurant prices.
And you don't have to tip.
And you don't have to tip, that's right.
Shoppers have also been reaching for fewer name brand products on the shelves and buying Shaw's own store brand stuff instead. Witinski invested in quality and marketing. He wants to keep those strong sales as times get better.
Those customers, they're not going to all of a sudden flip the switch and go back and start wanting to pay more.
Recessions are tough on businesses and the people who work for them. But like race cars trying to build momentum for the straightaway, some companies are gaining market share by hitting the gas while they're still coming out of the curve. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You know what it's like to shop with a vengeance, but what about shopping with a conscience? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, in the middle of a recession, which we are in now, it is normal to fixate on the monthly release of unemployment numbers. A good set of numbers can make the market soar. Bad numbers can cause the markets to dive. But those numbers aren't just numbers. They represent people. And a recent New York Times CBS poll of unemployed workers has neatly captured what is on their minds and how unemployment is changing their lives. New York Times reporter Michael Luo co-wrote the story on the poll, and he's with us today. Welcome to the program, or welcome back, I should say.
It's good to be here.
Michael, you start off the piece saying that more than half of the nation's unemployed workers have borrowed money from friends or relatives since losing their jobs. An equal number have cut back on doctor visits or medical treatments because they are out of work. And almost half have suffered from depression or anxiety. Were you surprised by this?
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily surprised, but I think taken all together, the findings really do capture the depth of the trauma from unemployment. And I think that really impressed me and moved me and saddened me.
You go on to talk about how a quarter of those polled have been threatened with foreclosure or eviction, and a quarter have received food stamps. The number that we use, that's a 10% figure, is shocking enough, but I wonder if perhaps one of these other figures isn't more telling about how this recession is really affecting people. I mean, if you were to pick sort of one thing that people have talked to you about that really shook them to their core, what do you think it would be?
I think the one about where we ask people, are you afraid that you are in danger of falling out of your current social class? nearly half of people said that. And that I think that really goes to the heart of the level of fear that's going on out there in the country, especially as unemployment drags on for a lot of people. I mean, just the idea that you could go from middle class to working poor or working poor to below that, that just really captures the fear that's out there.
You also write that nearly half of the adults surveyed admitted to feeling embarrassed or ashamed most of the time or sometimes as a result of being out of work. And you say perhaps unsurprisingly, given the traditional image of men as breadwinners, men were significantly more likely than women to report feeling ashamed most of the time. One of the things I'm curious about is why are they ashamed when they can read the same papers you do and realize that this unemployment is happening to a lot of people? Why do you think that is? I know you're not a psychologist, but I'm interested in what people said.
I think there is still a sense, especially for men, that it's tied to their identity and their provider, they're the breadwinner. And even though these people, most of these people were laid off, not fired, there still is a sense that it must be tied to performance or it must be my fault, when reality is that's not the case for most people across the country at this point.
Given that so many people did report being ashamed or embarrassed, was it hard to get people to talk to you?
When I called people, I think they enjoyed just talking to somebody. Some people actually said to me, I appreciate that somebody is asking about my life and my situation. In the end, a lot of people, I think, out there want others to know that they're not alone. And that is a big motivator for people. And another potential side benefit is sometimes when people read these stories, they want to help. And that's what I found the day the story ran, that I'm being inundated with emails from people saying, can I help this person? There was a person I quoted in the story who talked about how she was, her and her husband were saving quarters for diapers, and a lot of people want to send her diapers. So that's been really gratifying.
The online package of items around the story includes video clips of unemployed individuals telling their stories. I just want to play a clip from one of them, a gentleman called Bill Grierson.
Basically, when you have no job, you have no money for any type of emergency situations, car repairs, things of that nature. So you're just always hoping that everything goes well. And you hate to have to go to people and ask for a loan from your family, but we have had some help and whatnot. It's also been kind of, you know, depressing and or sad not to be able to provide for your children the way you'd like to. They play sports and there's certain things that they just haven't been able to do, equipment or whatnot. But again, we have had some help and, you know, people volunteering to help with that.
That is hard. You know, you can hear in his voice, it's almost the words tumbling out. It's almost like he doesn't want to tell you.
It's really, really personal. We don't talk about money a lot of times. There's a taboo of that. There's embarrassment, but also just this desire to vent and to share.
What other reactions are you getting? You mentioned that there are people calling you now who are responding to specific needs that you wrote about in the piece. What are some of the other reactions?
There have already been a couple, the 100 comments by lunchtime, the day the story ran to the article. And we actually did get a call into the national desk from a law firm in Los Angeles asking about one person, Evan Gutierrez, who is in Los Angeles, saying that they would like to interview him for a job. I don't really know if it actually fits him, but I pass it along to him. And just a lot of people writing about their own experience. I mean, there are some sort of inevitable sort of detractors who are like, you needed a poll to know some of this stuff. I mean, it's not rocket science. But I really did think that it laid bare what's going on out there.
And finally, what do you think is the next step in this reporting? What else do you think you'd like to know?
I guess, like, sometimes we hear about these horrible situations where just one disaster on top of another, losing their home, losing their car, medical issue, a funeral expense. And we think that that must be some kind of outlier. And it sometimes even when I write these stories and I have an anecdote like that, my editor sometimes wonders if it's too, you know, extreme. But just randomly calling some of these people back, the number of people who really had one of those sort of when it rains, it pours type situations was very common. And it made me think, we need to dive deeper in that. There really is a lot of suffering going on out there. And I mean, I just think that, you know, there are all kinds of things in this poll that will be interesting to explore.
Can I just ask you before I let you go, was there one story that you just cannot get out of your head? I know as a journalist, sometimes there's a story that just keeps me up at night. And I just, for whatever reason, I just can't get it out of my head. Was there a story like that for you?
I think there are multiple examples of that. I mean, I think the woman, Tammy Linville, who was quoted, and there's been a lot of feedback on her, she sort of had answered yes to feeling depressed or anxious, yes to seeing a mental health professional. She was dealing with her car breaking down. She had two small children, and there were just too many of those stories that to even include.
Michael Luo is a reporter with the New York Times. He joined us from his office in New York. Michael, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
If you want to read the piece that we're talking about, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More.